Next up is Friendly Fire, A Voice for Veterans with Don Kimball, who is himself an Air Force veteran. Friendly Fire is broadcast every Friday at 10 a.m. right here on KURU 89.1 FM, Silver City, New Mexico, and on the web at gmcr.org.
And our theme song, John Farnerman, You're the Voice. Welcome to Friendly Fire, A Voice for Veterans. I'm your host, Don Kimball. It's a pleasure to have you along today. We're recording from a remote location we call the Sacred Feather Studios, and we're very glad to be on KURU-FM 89.1, gmcr.org. First, we'll go to our interview with clinical therapist San Pao, and then later on for our second part of our show, we have Kevin Gostola from September of 2018 with a special call-in from the Lincolnton County Jail from United States Air Force veteran and whistleblower, Reality L. Winner. With us, we're very proud and pleased to have calling in from Gorham, Maine, a Army National Guard veteran, San Pao. He enlisted in 2001, just before graduating from Deering High School. He began basic training 1 month after the 9/11 attacks and was deployed to Iraq in 2004. San now lives with his family in Gorham, Maine, where he is trained now as a clinical therapist. San, thanks for taking the time to be on Friendly Fire today.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And how long have you been trained as a clinical therapist now?
So I got done with my schooling in 2018, and I started that journey in 2016. So now I'm still working my way through, and it's a daily journey, obviously, and I look forward to doing it for a long time.
Is what you do now as a clinical therapist full-time?
I am not doing it full-time. I'm doing it part-time, and I also have a full-time career outside of being a clinical therapist. But in terms of the guard, I wanted something totally different when I left, and this is one of the things that I know is a common denominator for folks like myself, you, and you know, everybody who's getting out or transitioning out is like a loss of identity, right? So when I was getting out, I'm like, what on earth am I going to do? You know, and it came back to what I always loved, and which is helping people. And then it transpired to, you know, who are the most affected? Wow. Those who are just getting out of the military, even those who have been out of the military that don't want to speak. And, you know, this is where I'm at.
Actually been trained not to perhaps show any kind of emotion, and then coming back and maybe going down a rabbit hole and not getting the help that they need. Now, you've a really interesting story about your family. You were actually born in a refugee camp in Thailand, and you're the son of a Cambodian professor who was driven from the homeland by Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime, which was, of course, a hardline communist, was in Cambodia and terrorized the countryside from 1975 to 79, killing, an estimates go from 1.7 to 3 million people. And after 2 years in the refugee camp, your family sought asylum in the United States and settled in Maine. So how did your family decide on Maine, or was it decided for you? Did you have a choice where you were immigrating to?
We were fortunate enough to be sponsored by a family in Augusta. That family took us in, and that's where we came. So I'm very fortunate to and happy to call Maine home.
Great. We're happy to have you. Now, is your whole extended family in Maine, or have people moved on to other places? Or
they're all over. Yeah, from Maine to Florida, California.
Oh, well, it's always good to have relatives in Florida, especially this time of year.
Oh, absolutely. I have great connections.
I'm coming for a visit. Yeah, watch out. Here I come. So you got here in
84.
84, and you're 39. You've got a wife and
how many kids? Two kids.
Okay, and they're keeping you busy. Are they school age yet? Are they being homeschooled, or do they get to go to school?
In an eighth grade, and the other one is eight in second grade. So they're doing the hybrid learning, and one is a little challenging for hybrid because you know, everybody is learns at different paces, and especially kids, right?
Sure.
Where one could be all about the school environment where they're thriving, and then you throw them online and they're just like, ah, this is not me, Dad. I know, I get it.
When you say hybrid, Sand, for those of us who don't have kids in school, is that like 2 days in the classroom and 3 days at home on the computer? Is that how it works?
Yeah, two on, three off, or two at home, or two at school and three at home.
Yeah. So pandemic is so challenging for so many people for so many reasons. I heard a quote the other day that the pandemic is the biggest gateway drug there is, and that people are increasing self-medicating because of the pandemic, the anxiety, the fear, the uncertainty that comes with it all. What have you seen in your, as a clinical therapist, that's kind of goes along that line?
It absolutely is increasing. I have not just my own clients, but others who are calling me to consult. And these folks and individuals, as we can imagine, you know, the uncertainty of the unknown is that the biggest factor. And so when that pandemic hit, and it still is happening, right, some of, we'll just say us, as in those who are, you know, veterans, they're shutting down, they're closing down, and it's hard to maneuver forward when, you know, everything that you had for a social outlet or outcome is being shut down, or that their fear affects us most.
The face-to-face contact is so important, and really it's been limited to Zoom meetings. I imagine that you're not having anybody in your office yet, right?
No, we had shut down a few months back because of the increase, and we plan on opening back up for face-to-face interaction slowly, but that's going to be in a little bit.
Once the vaccine becomes available to everybody, there's hope. Not just some hope, there is hope. Spring is just around the corner. We're going to spring forward on the clocks here in about another 2 weeks. So we'll take any kind of positive news that we can get right now, whether how little or how small it is. When did you decide, Sam, to go into becoming a clinical therapist? Because I know from the article that I read, Models of Courage, in which you were featured in the Portland Press Herald magazine section of Sunday, November 8th, 2020, that you, as a result of your tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, have post-traumatic stress disorder.
So for me, my wife and I were finishing up our undergraduate degrees in 2014, and we're wrapping it all up, and we're just going back and forth. We just had our daughter was maybe a year old at the time, and honestly, it was hectic having a young one plus a 1 year old. And so at that time, it was like, all right, well, you know, we're not done with school yet, so who's going next? And honestly, the easiest thing was, you know, to let my wife go through and get her master's degree to become a clinical therapist as well. So she started that journey, and I really enjoyed what she was going through, and I saw a lot of differences that she was making. And I was thinking about going to, you know, law school to do immigration. But at the same time, you know, the thoughts were, where can my biggest help and accomplishments be? And it was with veterans.
That's outstanding. And how long was the training?
The school was 2 years. Graduate school was 2 years for me.
Okay. And you have to get a license to practice in every state that you're in, similar to like a physician or something like that?
We only practice in Maine. And the training actually starts with your foundation year in grad school for our journey. And so started in grad school in 2016. And then once you get done with all your things that you need to do for graduation, and then you take your exam, take two exams. So I have one more exam to go to be fully licensed.
Oh, good luck with that. And of course, you have somebody in the house that can help you with that. How good is that, right?
I know.
Hey, honey, what's the answer to this one again?
Yeah.
Do you have the flash? Do you have the flashcards going? Get ready.
Oh, I will have all together.
Yeah. Well, if you're comfortable talking about it now, the term post-traumatic stress disorder is used a lot nowadays. Like in the old days, even before I was born, World War One, of course, it was called people who came back with issues from being in battle. It was called shell shocked. And this is when the medical community first started to really pay attention to what was happening to people's soldiers' minds and bodies. They were not made to shoot these artillery shells at other human beings and not made and to receive it also. Of course, even worse, the medical community started recognizing shell shock. They called it shell shock. Now we go to World War II, and they called it battle fatigue. They're beginning to notice, okay, people who are deployed, they're out in the field, they're cold, they're tired, they're hungry, they're scared, they're seeing their buddies blown to bits every day, wondering if my number's up next. It's taken a toll on people. They called it battle fatigue. Now, post-traumatic stress disorder, which combines the two of those, and what has added into that to call it post-traumatic stress disorder? Is it a combination of the battle fatigue, the shell shock, and now the chemical exposures that people are subjected to? In Vietnam, it was Agent Orange. In the Iraq and the Gulf War, it was depleted uranium, the burn pits. Are these things factored into it also? I mean, it's a complex issue, I know.
Absolutely complex, multi-layered, and it's very fascinating with just how things progress, right? It's almost like an ecosystem that just transforms into what we know now, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And all of it takes into factors, right? Because the psychological and emotional parts of it is very, very draining. And as we know that, you know, if you have some physical limitations or disabilities, it can lead to emotional turmoil and vice versa, right? And so from here, veterans like myself, anybody can be affected. And once that happens, you know, it's just how fast can you get out and how can you maintain? We would often feel scared, alone. And even though we have others around us who could help pull us out, we're thinking we're the only ones taking this journey when we're not. That's the truth of it.
The Department of Veterans Affairs discovered that veterans are more likely to develop symptoms of PTSD for a number of reasons. Longer times in theaters of war, lower levels of education, more severe combat conditions, other soldiers around them that are KIA, brain head trauma. It says females are more susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder. And these are VA statistics. And then life-lasting physical injuries, which you mentioned. And then, of course, and then it says kind of a nebulous thing of military structure. You said in this article that the ones who are able to continue on positively are the ones who are going to keep their hands busy so their mind isn't idle. How do you incorporate that into your practice?
So for my own personal end of it, I, you know, like I said earlier, I have a different career outside of being a mental health therapist. It's because of that, right? Because I want to be able to keep my hands occupied and doing other things that aren't just sitting idle. As much as helping folks is wonderful path and nature and loving and all of the above. And at the same time, I need something for myself too. And that's my own self-care. Right. And that's what we need to do is finding an outlet that is positive in nature that can help a positive outlook.
How closely do you work with other agencies or Veterans Administration in networking, finding out what the latest tools are that can help as a clinical therapist?
We're just expanding now to network out further as we've been contacted by several folks and several agencies to see what we can do to help them. And so for myself, I am partnering up with a fellow clinician at our practice who will be doing some art therapy with some kids. And so when we do that, and we're going to move on to working with adults and veterans with post-traumatic.
There's an operation called Operation Wellness, which is in your neck of the woods. Rob Foley, do you know him?
I do.
Yeah, we had Rob on. Yeah, we've had him on the show before. Yeah, he's great. And of course, they have the art therapy that they use there, as well as the horse therapy. I think the art therapy is based on an artist's last name, Pollock. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Therapy? Yeah. And have you tried it?
I have not.
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting. And for folks who are know a veteran in crisis or concerned about one, they can always call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. That's the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. Sandy, you also said in this article that the beauty of the veteran's mindset is that they will adapt, overcome with the right influences and the right support. So the right influences would be what? We know the right support is going to get help from folks like yourself. Right influences would be
other. So right influences would be the other veterans who are the ones who are not, in a sense, judging, right? Because when we share things with folks, we want to feel that, one, we're being validated, right? And when we're not feeling validated, we're not feeling supported. We're not feeling that the empathy is not being provided to us. Not that we're asking for it, but we need it. We need it, right? So the right influences are those who we could seek and look at as role models, who are, has been in our shoes and can show that, hey, you know what? We don't have to be perfect. We don't have to try to be perfect anymore. You know, we're in a different place. We're safe right now. But even if we don't feel safe, we can call for help. And that's the hard part, right? Calling for help is very, very difficult. And so being in the right environment is having friends and families who don't just wait to say, hey, you know what, Don, let me know when I can help you, right? But rather than that, it's going to be, hey, Don, I'm going to come over. I'm going to make this great food. I'm going to stop over and we're going to chit-chat. We're going to talk, right? And with those examples that I just showed, one is providing more of, hey, here's an option for you, Don. You can give me a call when you need help, right? The other option is more of, hey, I'm not really giving you an option, Don. I'm just going to stop over. I'm going to make this food because I can see it. I can see that you need some help. So I'm not going to have you ask for help. I'm going to give it to you right now.
They go being proactive and just listening to verbal clues. If you're on a Zoom meeting, you know, some visual clues, really being in tune. Now, unfortunately, you lost a friend to a suicide bombing in a dining hall, in an IED explosion you lost a friend during a suicide bombing. And how did that affect you?
Yeah, so I lost Tommy Dossie and Lynn Pullen at the same time over there for that suicide bombing. And, you know, I recall that day, and just like everybody else who was there, you know, and even folks who are home, you know, just listening and watching, they're just like, I remember where I was at. I remember what I was doing. For me, it took a long time, you know, because it first started with Chris Yalino, who I was in an ambush with, and he passed on. And that entire war was of, it could have been, it should have been. Why was it me? Why did I not die? You know, they had so many things that were outstanding going on in their lives, and it should have been me and not them, right? And so that took a long time just to get out of my head. And it took a lot of work.
I'm so sorry for your loss. Are you still in touch with their families?
I am. I am with more so with Chris Chalino's family.
And you consider yourself not only a friend, but a resource for them also. You've made yourself available so they can talk.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are you still in touch with other people who are still active duty?
So I am still in touch with a lot of folks, and a lot of folks has also reached out as those who are just progressing to or transitioning to getting out, asking, what do I do next, son? Who do I need to see? Okay, so I'm feeling this. What do you think? You know, so I'll share.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that was it.
Okay, I was going to say, are active duty personnel, in your estimation, from what the feedback that you're getting from people that are still in, are they getting more assistance from the VA or from the Pentagon in with post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide prevention, or is it just kind of status quo, Sam?
So I don't have a lot of information on that end or knowledge on what's happening with them. But what I do know is that the ones who are calling me has already reached out to the VA or reached out further, and they're not getting much help on their end. That's the only folks I can speak about.
Right. Now, recently, of course, medical marijuana has become available. Is that something that you, of course, you can't prescribe or diagnose, but is this something that you recommend, or have you gotten feedback that this has helped people who are coping with post-traumatic stress disorder and any other maladies that they may have, even pain management?
It does intrigue me, and I'd like to do more research on my end to see how it does help or not help folks and how it works. You know, I've heard many great things about it, but at the same time, I don't have enough information on my end to make that kind of ruling or decision.
Sure, I understand completely. And it's relatively new. I think medical marijuana has only been legal in Maine for perhaps 2-3 years now. There's many different forms that people can get it in and very in different doses. And it's certainly anything that's not a pharmaceutical, a natural therapy would be better than a pharmaceutical avenue. Or that's kind of the avenue of last resort. So sunshine, singing, music, friends, outdoor activities, even animal therapy. We've had some folks on the show lately from Pets for Vets, Marianne Quinn and company, and they match rescue animals with veterans, and it's a great program. Have you recommended that to some of your clients, or do you have a rescue animal yourself?
I have a rescue animal, but not through any of those organizations. Our dog is awesome. Allie is great. And so as you were just talking about more of perhaps a different approach to mental health, right, with medical marijuana, I do recommend for counseling, right, counseling and or medication management. With the right medication management and counseling, things can be improved in a much better way and much better light. I also do recommend essential oils. I use essential oils myself, and I have many veterans and many first responders that are affected with post-traumatic stress disorder who do enjoy it and who does like it.
Sam, do you have a Facebook page that people could go to contact you if they want more information about what you do?
Yeah, they can go on to Restorative Wellness Facebook page, and I can send you the link on that. So the other one that I wanted to mention before I forget is CBTI is a great modality that I utilize to help work with veterans. And so the I is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And so it doesn't mean necessarily just sleep, but more so just to help re-regulate and make things better, along with some nutritional facts and intakes that folks can do that are natural and healthy.
Okay. And it's regenerative. Say the name again, please.
Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia.
Okay. And people can contact you on Facebook and find out more about that. We're also going to make available on the Friendly Fire Facebook page. There's the mental health resources for veterans. We already mentioned the Veterans Crisis Line. There's a confidential chat available at Veterans Crisis Line. And there's also coaching into care for families and friends. And there's also the VA main healthcare system. So it appears then that there's not a lack of programs out there. It's just finding the people that need it and then encouraging them to use it, because you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I just put two people together today, and you know, whether one reaches out for help is, it's up to them. That's all you can do, right?
Absolutely. And the other part is if the therapy or what they're doing is effective to them, is it the right fit?
Now, I know that you're a busy guy. Are you comfortable talking about a veteran suicide?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because, you know, veteran suicide is such a touchy issue. And unfortunately, military personnel are in a subgroup that is at an elevated risk of suicide. And others that are in that subgroup are the LGBTQ community and folks that are Native Americans. On average, 22 veterans a day choose death by suicide. This number has stayed somewhat constant over the past 5 or 6 years. What can we do to stop this epidemic, San, from continuing, this terrible toll it's taking on society?
Yeah, unfortunately, some of us are predispositioned to suicide or have that component within our own self system to be in that situation, where what that means is that, you know, veterans, well, obviously what we're talking about, yes, is that typically it's more of when something happens, you know, veterans will just go out and do it. They're not even thinking about it at that point. Right. And so,
so it's a very rash decision sometimes made within 5 minutes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. That we can combat suicide is knowing the dangers or knowing where our loved ones and friends are at that very moment. So as one example would be, okay, so we've got this one veteran who is super depressed and knows that, one, you know, you've got an easy access to guns do a lot, you know, so it does a lot of damage. And so when we have an easy access to self-harm with that gun, chances are is that if we don't take it away, most likely it's going to end in that situation. So how do we combat that? Well, the veteran is for a long time feeling very down, feeling depressed, hopeless. And then all of a sudden this one veteran is super happy. Things are quiet down, it appears, right? And it shows that for the next week or two, this veteran is, hey, everything is going much better. Things are going great. And then the veteran dies by suicide, right? And so what happened is that the veteran died by suicide. And we're just thinking, I didn't see it coming. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. Or I should have done this. I should have done that. And it's no one's fault, really, right? And how do we combat that? Well, it's knowing what happened, what led to it, right? When we notice that someone is sad, unhappy, depressed, hopeless, they become happy. That's when we need to really step up our ball game, as we should be stepping up ball game long before that. But oftentimes it doesn't happen until it's towards the end. And that's where we need to also identify our own maturities with being able to step forward, because it is scary.
Yeah, it's so difficult to predict. So basically, mm-hmm, what you're saying is what folks who are concerned about a military member or any family member or friend who could be suicidal is to watch for a change in behavior, a significant change in behavior. Certainly don't let firearms be accessible. Make sure they're unloaded. Make sure they have a trigger lock on them and they're put somewhere away in a closet or an attic or something. The harder it is to get to that weapon and use it, the better it is, the less chance that the victim would use it. It's really a difficult subject to talk about, but one that we need to talk about because it's so critical to the safety and the welfare of not just veterans, but society in general. We just can't let this 22 a day figure go on. I know there's a program I'm not too familiar with that it's called Red Flag. Basically, if a family member was concerned about somebody who they thought was in a bad position, they would call law enforcement, and law enforcement it would have to get a court order to come to the home and take the firearm. So, of course, with people who are concerned with, you know, Second Amendment rights and everything like that, you know, they would probably not be in favor of this, but it's called Red Flag, something you might want to check out. All right. Well, Sam, we thank you so much for being with us here today on Friendly Fire, and we wish you success with your job as a clinical therapist. And you didn't mention what else you do, but feel free to mention it if you want.
I am also a contractor.
Hard to get good contractors, so we know that you're good. We know that you're good. We know that you're a good one, right?
We're busy, and I have several guys who are working for me, and so they're helping me afford the time to also take care of my clients in the mental health world.
Great. And any parting advice for people who need to help during this pandemic?
Yeah, talk to people you trust, talk to people you love, talk to anyone, really, because even if you talk to a stranger, they're going to listen. And even when we think that nobody's listening or care to listen, they do want to listen. They'd rather listen to you than bury you.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Sam, thank you so much for being on.
You rock. Thank you, Don.
All right, take care.
You're welcome.
And we hope you enjoyed today's interview with San Pao of Gorman, who served with the Maine Army National Guard in Iraq and Afghanistan and now helps veterans as a clinical therapist. And as we mentioned before, there are 17 states that have recently passed laws known as red flag laws, which provide help to families and the community, also known as extreme risk protection orders, that allow a court to intervene when someone shows warning signs of impending violence. Advocates say that protection orders such as these address gaps in federal law, which bars people from having weapons only if they have been convicted of certain crimes, if they are determined to have a mental illness or have been involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital, or if they are subjected to a final domestic violence restraining order. Protection orders take weapons out of the hands of those who should not have them without infringing on the rights of law-abiding gun owners, says Dr. Mark Rosenberg, who oversaw the gun violence research at the Centers for Disease Control. Protection orders are a vital tool, quote-unquote, that allows the people who are most likely to notice when a loved one or a community member becomes a danger to take concrete steps to disarm them, according to Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, a San Francisco-based advocacy group named for Gabrielle Giffords, the former congresswoman who survived a mass shooting. I had the distinct pleasure of meeting the former congresswoman Gabby Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly, now Senator Kelly, a few years back, and I got to tell you that there's no better representative for trying to fix what's wrong with America when it comes to too many weapons and too many people being shot and killed than Gabby Giffords. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll go to our interview from September of 2018 with author and journalist Kevin Gostola, who covered the Reality L. Winter trial down in Augusta, Georgia. And this features a rare call-in from Reality L. Winter from the Lincolnton County Jail. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Friendly Fire on KURU 89.1 FM, Silver City, New Mexico, and on the web at gmcr.org. And now, back to Friendly Fire with Don Kimball.
Many of you have probably never even heard Reality's voice since she's been silenced in her 63-month sentence. Reality was 25 years old when this interview took place. She's now 29 years old, still behind bars.
Thanks for calling in to the show, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Great to have you on. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us tonight. We're mostly going to concentrate on, of course, Reality Winner's case. Of course, last week we had Reality's mom, and we had Lisa Ling on to speak with Reality last week off air, and it was great to talk to her. So this has kind of become not fake news, but real news, and we'll just call it Reality News, Reality Radio. How about that? So, Kevin, go ahead and tell us about you were down there for the sentencing of Reality Winner. She received the longest sentence, unfortunately, that a whistleblower has received yet in at least modern times in the United States. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The Justice Department was very proud of their accomplishment. Bobby Christine was from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of Georgia. Of course, people probably know she was prosecuted. The proceedings went on in Augusta, Georgia, nearby where she was stationed and working as an NSA contractor. They were very proud that they had achieved the longest sentence ever for an unauthorized disclosure. And while they didn't get the maximum punishment under the Espionage Act, a person who violates it can go to jail for up to 10 years. They nonetheless were happy with 5 years. And one of the reasons that would be the case is people typically don't go to jail this long for releasing classified information. And so you have previous cases where people have been charged by the federal government and they only went to prison for 42 months, or they went to prison and got a plea deal for 30 months. And in this case, you see something extraordinary where she's looking at being in jail for 5 years. Of course, she's already been in prison for a year during the trial process, during the process of her case, because she was denied bail, which is another extraordinary aspect of her prosecution of the case. Yeah, being down there, it was remarkable to see her brought out into the middle of the courtroom. I think something that Billy has said to people is that she could hear the shackles clanging on the floor when they were taking her handcuffs off. She stood before the lectern and addressed the judge, made a statement. Her defense attorneys made a statement, basically begging for mercy. Because, you know, the sort of thing she did, she can't really tell the judge why she did it. She can't get into her motives, her intentions. She can't try to find some kind of rational justification or get the prosecutors to find their way to leniency. The system is that you go before the judge and you beg for mercy and you say things that you probably didn't think you were going to have to say in order to make sure you don't go to jail for a long time.
And this is the Espionage Act that she's was charged under. And maybe we should back up just a bit. Reality Winner is a 26-year-old United States Air Force veteran who was charged under the Espionage Act with one count of releasing a classified document. She originally pled not guilty and then knew that the deck was stacked against her because of this archaic law, again, that is the Espionage Act, and ended up pleading guilty, will serve 63 months. She applied, she was denied bail four times. Right now she's in jail in Lincolnton, Georgia, a county jail, I'm assuming. Soon she will be moved to the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Yeah, no, exactly. And the Espionage Act, just for people quickly, is this law from 1917 that was put on the book. The government wanted to go after people who were seditious, who were mostly engaged in communist activities. Also, it was wartime. They didn't want military officers to desert or leave their post or speak out against the war, so they used it to go after them. And it's a law that was around and used. Think of like the Red Scare. And then, of course, the big high-profile case of Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers whistleblower. That happened. They came after him with the Espionage Act, but then they were corrupt themselves. They were engaging in tampering with evidence and obstruction and all kinds of different acts, so that case was dismissed and it didn't set a precedent. And then you have in the 80s a case involving Samuel Morrison, who was someone who had leaked a blueprint of like a Navy ship or something, and it ended up in a small publication called Jane's Defense Weekly. And then from that point on, you develop a model. You see that from Reagan on through the 90s and then especially in the 2000s, and dramatically under President Barack Obama, you developed this model, and that's the kind of model that was used against Reality Winner. You developed this model for how you can charge somebody with violating the Espionage Act when they release information to the press, when they're a source, when they're someone who, for the most part, they're not doing anything treasonous. They haven't betrayed their country, although the Justice Department talks about them like that. But they really had a concern about something that was going on in their agency or place of work, and they released that information to an outlet.
And are there similarities, since you've covered both trials, between the Bradley Manning trial, the way he was charged and sentenced, and Reality's trial and sentence?
Yes, so I think when you're looking at the Manning case, there was a ton of information. It's far different. But what stands out to me, what I take away, is just the fact that it seems like there were far more opportunities. There was at least a decorum, a sort of a process where, you know, even though you had the whole book thrown at you as a military officer, I felt like Manning found a way to plead guilty to some of the charges and find that opportunity to explain to the public what happened. And it just seems like it's so difficult here in this case. Like, we still don't really know what happened in Reality's mind beyond the fact that, as the public, I mean, and I mean this as somebody who looks at this case with great interest, we don't know beyond the confession that was coerced from her through an interrogation by FBI agents in her very, very small home during a raid. We don't really know, you know, what particularly she thought of this document. And the fact is that we may never know, because she can't actually speak about it. The government could revoke this plea agreement and send her back to trial and slap on additional charges if she would talk about the contents. I'm afraid for her that if she actually told us the truth of what was going on in her head that day and why she released this document, that there would just be more punishment layered on.
Yeah, the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Trump administration do not want the public to know that the reason Reality Winner released this document was to help one more piece of the puzzle to help prove that there was Russian interference in the presidential election. And of course, Trump, with his ego and everything, saying that there was 100,000 people in the stands when there was like 1,000. And, you know, he doesn't want to admit that, you know, the Russians helped him get into the White House, similar to Comey. There was after Reality sentencing, there was an article in the paper, Tribune News Service out of Atlanta, that has a wonderful picture for those folks who want to go back and look at that, of Reality going to her sentencing in her orange jumpsuit with big smile on her face, flashing the peace sign. And she said that she takes full responsibility for my actions, was the quote. And something also, I'm sure you'll agree, Kevin, that's very troubling, is the government looking into her personal text messages. This is very troubling that the government is going this far in its war on whistleblowers. And I think you'll agree, it is a war on whistleblowers.
Oh, absolutely. It is a war. It is a crackdown. It's methodically been approached. We're used to paint her as a sort of like Taliban sympathizer. Accuse her of maybe wanting to go over and help people who are deemed terrorists by our government. But all she really wanted to do is eventually at some point engage in humanitarian aid, help refugees, help address a crisis that many of the wars we've been involved in have created. Instead of seeing that as something admirable, it's used against her. She's treated as public enemy, number one. And then, like you say, looking at those text messages to maximize the character assassination of Reality Winner, going through these private messages between her and family members and reading into jokes, very clearly, anyone who looks at these can recognize that this is humor, that someone is being sarcastic. She's joking about air conditioning in the United States and saying that's something that makes her hate America. She's also then adding something political and serious about the country and getting into issues of the environment. And then that's used to paint her as some kind of turncoat against the United States.
Our guest tonight is, we're very pleased to have him, Kevin Gustola, calling in from Chicago. He is an author, activist, journalist. He's covered the Bradley Manning trial and the trial and sentencing of Reality Winner. This is Friendly Fire. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Reality's case and what we can do to help set her free. And we're going to have a special guest call in. So stay tuned. That's Deep Purple, Child in Time. In the time that we have left, Kevin, and I failed to mention, folks, that Kevin is also the managing editor of Shadowproof.com. And if people go to Shadowproof.com, they can find out a lot more about what you do, about this case, and about other cases. And also, if they go to Stand With Reality, there's lots of ways to get involved and bring Reality's case to light. So a pardon is definitely a possibility. And there's also a petition going around, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, they definitely are pursuing that, and that's been a standard. I mean, Manning went after a pardon, and there are other people who are seeking pardons still as well. So she technically is at the mercy of a president going forward, and so she can appeal, she can ask Donald Trump or the next president, whomever is in office after, and she could spend the rest of her life seeking a pardon. Many people in this country do, but that's the only way she's going to be able to get this off her record.
We need folks to, you know, politely call the White House, politely call and write their elected officials.
I think you put it very concisely, and you're absolutely right.
On the other line, we have, from Lincolnton, Georgia, our hero, Reality Winner. Reality, welcome to Friendly Fire. Thank you so much for taking some time to call in, and thank Kevin and everybody else who's...
Oh, well, thank you for having me. You know, I heard y'all were talking about me tonight, so I just thought I would crash the last couple minutes of your show, if you don't mind.
No, we definitely love having you on. We hope that you're doing well. If you can give us whatever information that you provide us about your situation that you feel comfortable talking about, you know, the people out there would love to hear from you.
Right. So at this moment in time, I'm just awaiting transport, obviously, for 6 weeks. We're not going to know ahead of time, so that's unfortunate. So for me, it's just nerve-wracking, you know, for my mom, too. But that's normal. It's just part of the process. We're also collecting signatures for the petition, but, you know, I don't really get my hopes up about that because, of course, it's going to go through the same system, the same departments that kind of put me in this mess to begin with, but that's okay. So I'm just looking for better living conditions, you know, moving forward with my life, being closer to family, and just thanking everybody for all the support, as well as, you know, kind of getting the word out about this situation. I know there was a clemency feedback session in the White House just today. So, again, I don't sit around waiting for the blessings, but, you know, when you're in here, that's all you have, that little bit of hope.
And should people continue to write to the Lincoln County Jail, or do you have a new address, Reality, that people can write to, or should they still go to write to the Lincoln County Jail?
Well, at this moment in time, I would advise people to stand by. The Lincoln County Jail does not forward mail, and like I said, I mean, I could leave tomorrow, I could leave Friday, I could, you know, leave any weekday or weekend. I mean, it's pretty random. So, you know, I would say hold off, and then as soon as I know my stable writing address, we will get it to everybody, because I can't wait to hear from y'all.
Okay, so the best thing people can do right now, you think, is to write to the president and ask politely for a pardon, and then sign the petition with standwithreality.com?
Absolutely. You know, I've actually been calling the White House a couple times. I got the number blocked here at the jail, but that's okay. You know, try to get through to the aide. They kind of pause when I say, I'm Reality Winner. I'd like to talk to the president. But right now, I just feel like if I could just speak to him for 5 minutes, you know, thank him for, you know, of course, the tweet that garnered so much more attention for me, positive attention, mind you. that would be just wonderful for me, you know, and just to also, you know, speak to the president. Who doesn't want to do that?
Kevin, do you want to say hi? Kevin, do you want to say hi to reality?
Well, I guess I should say hello, and that I've been following your case, and I think that you've held up remarkably well given the circumstances.
Oh, well, thank you so much for the support and keeping my name out there. It means everything to me to know that I'm not forgotten.
You've got some really great people on your side, Reality. How are you feeling in there? I know that you've had some health issues, and who wouldn't, being subjected to what you're being subjected to? How are you holding up?
I try not to think about it. You know, I can get up. I can still do handstand push-ups, and, I mean, who could ask for more? I just feel like this has been kind of conditioning me to the point where anything is an improvement. But there's good people here, and, you know, we're all just trying to get by. We're all on this boat.
And you've made some good friends there.
Definitely, yeah.
And that's awesome. And we'll look forward to hearing from you when you get to, hopefully, the Federal Medical Center in Carswell, in Carswell, Texas. But we really do appreciate you calling in. I think this is probably your first media interview from jail, and hopefully the next time we talk to you, feel free to call into the show anytime, by the way, you'll be on the outside. And I think maybe people on the outside, we take our freedom for granted, don't we? And you could you know how precious it is now, right?
Definitely. I will never live a day after this where I'm not just grateful to be able to get up and walk outside. But I just wanted to thank everybody, all the support, all the mail, the packages, the support to my mother, my family. Thank you so much for being there and just letting my family know that, you know, some of the horrible things said about me, they're not who I am. They don't define me. And, you know, for a mother, that just, I mean, that's everything. And that means the world to me.
Yep.
So just thank you so much, everybody.
Billy's listening in tonight, and she's the one that put this together. So we have her to thank for having Reality on our show. Reality, take good care of yourself. Stay in touch. And we'll look forward to talking to you, hopefully, from the great state of Texas the next time we talk. Thanks again so much for calling in, and know that you're a hero to a lot of people out here. You've got a lot of people that care about you and that love you, and you carry that with you every day. Hopefully you'll be on the outside soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Good night, everybody. God bless.
Good night.
Our guests tonight have been Kevin Gostola. He is an author, an activist, and a journalist, and he also is co-writing a book called Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. And, of course, he is an expert because he's been at the Reality Winner trial and the sentencing. Kevin, thanks so much for being on Friendly Fire. We'll have you again back real soon, huh?
All right. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right, Kevin. Good night now. That's going to wrap it up tonight, and we're going to play this song dedicated to Reality, Richie Havens. It's simply called Freedom. Good night, everybody.